Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touchtone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you so much, Stephanie, and I too would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect workshop, Medical Update on Acute Myelogenous Leukemia, or AML. Now, today's program is an important program for many of you on the call. Today's program is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and many other cancer organizations and blood cancer organizations, and it really is because of that collaboration that we have been able to reach so many of you on the call today. Now, we have on the call today over 690 participants, and you come from all over the United States. And we also have international participants from Bangladesh, Canada, Kenya, Russia, United Kingdom, and Venezuela. So you really come from all over the world, and it really is a credit to you that you are spending this next hour with us to get information about the treatment of AML. Now, today's program was made possible with a grant from Sunesis Pharmaceuticals, Inc., and I really want to thank them for their support of our program today. I would like to remind all of you that you did get an evaluation form from us at Cancer Care, and at the end of the program today, we would really appreciate your completing that evaluation form or feedback form. We so much depend upon your thoughts about our programs. You often make suggestions of programs you'd like us to offer, and you know, this is the beginning of 2015. We're planning a lot of programs, and so your suggestions are invaluable to us so that we pick the right programs for you. Indeed, today's program is one that many of you have asked us to offer, and here it is. So we try very hard to listen to your suggestions. Now, we have wonderful speakers today, and I want to begin by introducing our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Farhad Ravandi, and Dr. Ravandi is Professor of Medicine, Chief Section of Developmental Therapeutics, Department of Leukemia, University of Texas, MD Anderson Cancer Center. And Dr. Ravandi is going to address an overview of acute myelogenous leukemia, or AML, current treatment options, new therapies, and quality of life concerns. It's my pleasure now to turn the program over to Dr. Ravandi.
Thank you very much, and before I begin, I'd like to mention that I have a cold, so please bear with my occasional cough during the talk. So I am going to talk about initially an overview of AML and some of the treatment options that are available and are coming on. I'd like to call AML is a cancer of the bone marrow stem cells and bone marrow cells, and as many of you know, bone marrow is where the production of blood elements occur, such as white cells and red cells and platelets. And the way I actually describe this to my patients in the clinic is that there is a normal process of maturation of these cells in the bone marrow in the normal individuals, and you have cells that I would describe are at the baby stage, cells that are in the toddler stage, cells that are in teenage stage, and then the older teenagers start going into the peripheral blood as mature cells. And for some reason in disorders of bone marrow, particularly in AML, this normal process of maturation, and you can think of it as same as individuals, becomes abnormal. So these cells get arrested at various stages of maturation. And you may have heard of what we call blasts, and these are the leukemia cells, and these are really the baby cells. They are the earliest cells in the process of maturation. And because of this abnormality, the bone marrow becomes filled up with enormous numbers of blasts, and because of that, it actually stops the working of the normal working of the bone marrow and the normal production of peripheral blood elements. And obviously that is a problem because you need the peripheral blood elements, the white cells you need for fighting infections, the platelets you need to stop bleeding if you have a cut or any other bleeding, and the red cells you need for transfer of oxygen and not becoming anemic. And for years we have been trying to understand why this normal process of maturation has become disordered in AML patients. And I can tell you that over the last couple of decades, we have made enormous strides. We have studied these leukemia cells, and initially we found them to have abnormal chromosomes, and chromosomes are obviously where the genes are located in the cell. And then more recently, we've actually found abnormal genes in these leukemia cells. And I have to emphasize that these abnormal chromosomes and genes are only in the leukemia cells. You know, the rest of the AML patients' cells have completely normal constitution of genes and chromosomes. But because of these abnormalities, the cells in the bone marrow become arrested in their maturation, and as I mentioned earlier, the number of blasts and baby cells increases in the marrow. Now, again, in the clinic, I tell my patients, can you imagine a city when you have 50% of the population being babies? Obviously, that's going to break down the city's normal functioning because you obviously need people of various normal ages for a normal functioning of the city. And this is also true of the bone marrow. If you have excess of any immature elements, that's going to lead to the dysfunction of bone marrow function. As I mentioned, we are beginning to understand what causes this abnormalities in the genes and chromosomes, and that is actually very useful because this is leading to development of specific therapies, drugs that are actually directed against these specific abnormalities. We still treat AML with chemotherapy, and there are two class of drugs that are essentially standard for this disease treatment, and that is cytarabine and anthracyclines. They still play a significant role in this in the management of this disease. However, we are beginning to have clinical trials of interesting target-specific drugs, and hopefully this is going to lead to much better and more effective treatments in the future. The usefulness of these drugs are also because many of them are oral agents and have limited toxicity. And this is useful because of the quality of life question that obviously intensive chemotherapy that we have been giving to patients with AML over the years is associated with a significant amounts of side effects. The blood counts are actually further lowered by the chemotherapy, and the patients become more susceptible to infection and bleeding. And there are also side effects in other organs related to these chemotherapy agents. Now, I am not saying that none of these targeted therapies have any other side effects, but one potentially see that some of these agents will translate to more tolerable strategies that would be useful, particularly in older patients with AML. One of the predictors of outcome in AML is age, mainly because as the patient gets older, they are less able to tolerate these intensive chemotherapy regimens and the toxicities that are associated with it. So if we can develop regimens and strategies that are less toxic and just as effective or even more effective, we are going to significantly improve the outcomes of these patients. I think I have, do I have any more time?
If you wanted to say more.
Now, talking about the current treatment options, obviously one area that is many of you have heard about and has been a big element of treatment in AML is allogeneic stem cell transplant. Clearly, this is a strategy that can be curable in some patients, and it's advisable in many patients based on their gene and chromosome abnormalities that I mentioned. Because some types of AML with some specific gene and chromosome abnormalities are less likely to be curable just with chemotherapy strategies alone. Obviously, allogeneic stem cell transplant is a very effective strategy, but unfortunately, it's also associated with some degree of toxicity and unfortunately even a degree of morbidity and mortality. And in the past, it was only available to the youngest patients, but improvements in transplant strategies, there are now transplant regimens that can be used even in patients as old as 70. So that is clearly an option for certain individuals, and obviously that has to be a discussion between the patient and their physician. And again, there are some types of AML with some gene and chromosome abnormalities that we do not actually recommend to have allogeneic stem cell transplant in first remission. But again, as I mentioned, all of these intensive regimens do have some side effects and some quality of life issues. And again, I'm very hopeful that the more we understand AML and the way these genes and chromosome abnormalities lead to the development of AML, we will hopefully be able to have specific, relatively non-toxic, and more tolerated strategies in the future.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Rondi. That was excellent. I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A as well. Thank you so much. And our next presenter is Dr. James Ferran. Dr. Ferran is Associate Professor of Oncology, Mayo Clinic Cancer Center, Vice Chair, Research, Division of Hematology and Medical Oncology, Mayo Clinic, Florida. And Dr. Ferran is going to present on the role of clinical trials, how they increase your treatment options, symptom and pain management tips, and important questions to ask when communicating with your healthcare team. It's my pleasure now to turn the program over to Dr. Ferran.
Thanks very much. Hi, James Foran at Mayo Clinic. I just wanted to say thank you for the invitation to discuss these things and for you all to take the time to listen, and I'm looking forward to your questions. I've worked with Dr. Ravandi on many research trials in the past, and actually we serve on one of the national AML committees together, so it's a pleasure to do this with him as well, even though we're both in separate cities at the minute. So the questions that I was asked to address to start with is really in relation to clinical trials and how clinical trials increase your treatment options, and then how to help people with symptoms and pain related to leukemia and questions that you should be asking or considering when you go through therapy for leukemia. So I'm going to start with the issue of clinical trials. And some of you may have experience with this and some more than others, but they're really a critical tool for us to try to move the field forward and get better therapies. So a clinical research study, or also a clinical trial or a clinical protocol, is a means of developing and testing a new treatment in cancer care, whether it's AML or some other cancer, in which real people, real patients, participate as a volunteer. One of the most important things about a clinical trial is that we have to have a formal protocol or a formal study that we follow. The reason we do these is we want to advance research, improve patient care, and I will tell you that many of the tests and treatments that we use today exist because of clinical trials. And I wanted just to take 1 second to go through a couple of examples of that. If you look in the 1980s, there were important trials looking at chemotherapy in breast cancer and colon cancer that showed us that adjuvant chemotherapy work. And in the 1990s, some antibodies in different cancers like lymphoma. A little over 10 years ago, clinical trials helped discover imatinib and some of the newer drugs for chronic leukemias, not exactly germane to AML, but important. And then in the recent years, studies looking at angiogenesis or immunotherapy that have really moved the field forward. One of the problems we've had in acute myelogenous leukemia is that it's been harder to treat, and we've been trying hard in the trials. We haven't had the same success in the past as some of these other cancers, but that's an area I think will change in the near future, and trials are helping us to do that. So there are really two types of clinical trials. The first is a therapy trial or a clinical trial where we look at a new medical treatment or a new device or a new procedure. It helps us look to find the correct dose, to look for the benefit of a new treatment, to look for side effects of a new treatment, and sometimes we'll compare that to a standard treatment that's already available. Oftentimes this will be a situation where we don't have a standard treatment anymore, and we've certainly had been in that situation before in leukemia, so this has been very helpful for us to look for ways forward. When we talk about clinical trials or when you hear about them, you may hear about a phase 1 trial or a phase 2 trial or a phase 3 trial. And these are asking different questions. In a phase 1 study or a phase 1 trial, they're really some of the earliest studies to look what's the best dose that has the fewest side effects and is there any benefit. And typically they start with a low dose of the drug and work their way up in the dose until they see what level the side effects become too severe or what level they start to see the benefit or the desired effect. So the phase 1 studies are early and often of the newest medications or newest treatments. In a phase 2 study, we're looking in a larger group of patients. Once we know the right dose and once we think we have a feel for the side effects, we take it to a larger group and we typically focus it in one area of leukemia. And we test to see what are the results in that group of patients. And what is the benefit? What are the side effects? Anything new come up? A phase 3 study is when we compare a new treatment to whatever the standard of care is. So that's some treatment that already exists that people are using. And in phase 3, they're often randomized so that half the patients by chance are assigned to the regular treatment or the standard treatment, and the other half are assigned to the new treatment. And that's designed to really compare the new treatment against something that exists already. So that we break trials down into phase 1, the early trials to see what the right dose is, phase 2 to see how well it works in a group of patients, and phase 3 to do a comparison. And depending on what treatments you need for your leukemia, there may be a phase 1 or phase 2 or phase 3 clinical trial open. Now, excuse me, I said already that there's another type of clinical trial. It's called an observational study. And in an observational study, we're looking to assess the outcome in a group of patients by following in a certain way. So we don't necessarily try a new treatment or new intervention, but we're looking to see what happens to a group, a larger group, when you follow them over time. So that you may, for instance, observe a group of older adults to learn more about the effects of lifestyle on their risk of developing cancer or how that impacts what happens to them afterwards. And so an observational trial, we're just tracking the information to see what happens. In a clinical trial, we're actually giving a new therapy. I mentioned already that a lot of these trials compare to something called the standard of care. And that's a term that you might hear when you're thinking about a trial. And the standard of care really means the standard diagnostic tests and the standard treatments that experts and specialists in leukemia have already looked at, have already determined to be appropriate and accepted and well-tested and established. And there are different places you could look for to see what the guidelines for standard of care are. There are websites that you can look at to look up what is the standard of care, and then you can help determine what is the difference with the new treatment. So it helps us determine what the standard cost of a trial should be versus a research cost, helps us decide what's the standard treatment or way to follow somebody so we can make a comparison. I think one of the key questions when you're thinking about a clinical trial is why participate in one? What are the reasons to do one? Some of the reasons are obvious. If you were looking to find a more effective treatment to treat the remission, to treat the leukemia to get into remission or to prevent a relapse or even a better way for diagnosis, that helps move the field forward. One of the advantages of trials is they're monitored very carefully. We have to follow a written protocol. We have to follow guidelines called good clinical practice so that we get audited. And it means that we're really following rules in how we treat people, and that holds us to a very high standard when we're treating somebody on a trial. There are four general benefits, really, to being on a clinical trial. The first is that you get access to the most current cancer care for leukemia, for AML. The second is that you're almost always treated by an expert in the disease. So it's not just a general oncologist. It's somebody who really is an expert in acute myelogenous leukemia. The third is that the results of the study, whether they're good results or bad results, they're carefully tracked and reported. And the fourth is that in addition to helping yourself or your family member if they're on that trial, it helps other patients with acute myelogenous leukemia. So there are very strong reasons to think about going on a trial, but I think that it's important to note that there are also risks to going onto a clinical trial, and so you have to balance that. For instance, clinical trials do have some risks. There's always the possibility of an unknown side effect or an uncertain benefit. Sometimes there's more tests or more monitoring. Patients or family members who are on a clinical trial have extra visits sometimes or questionnaires or paperwork that they're asked to complete so we can learn more about what's happening. And even though this is never what we hope for, it's always possible that a new test or a new treatment may not work as well or may not be better than the one that we already have in use. So I think clinical trials are very important to consider. It's something that I've dedicated my career to. I know Dr. Ravandi has, and many of us who treat leukemia, to trying to find better treatments, and clinical trials is how we do that. But it's important to know that in addition to benefits, there are considerations that you have to make sure the trial is the right thing for you if you're thinking about going on to a trial. Now, I was asked to talk about how clinical trials increase options, and they definitely do increase options. There's new agents or new strategies that we get to test to see if it's a better way forward in acute myelogenous leukemia. The people who work on developing the clinical trials are usually what we call a thought leader or an expert in leukemia, so that it's somebody who really focuses on that disease and knows the disease very well and knows the genetics or the clinical aspects very well to try to come up with a better therapy or a better outcome for patients. The trials increase options at different stages of the disease. Some trials are meant to get more people into remission. Some trials are meant to actually decrease the toxicity of a treatment. Some are to prevent a relapse after you've finished your therapy. And all of them really are focused on trying to improve outcomes, whether that's just a quality of life where you feel better, or more importantly, a better, longer remission that may improve things for everybody with AML. Sometimes the trials themselves will get a remission that will allow us to consider other therapies. For instance, there are some clinical trials where if you see a patient get benefit and they go into remission, you'll sometimes think about doing a bone marrow transplant to improve upon that when you could not have done that when they were not in remission. So occasionally they serve as a bridge to another therapy. Even if on their own they don't get you a long-term outcome, they may open other opportunities for you. We feel that we almost always offer our best therapies on a trial. It's always important to look for a clinical trial and consider participating in one, but you also have to remember that trial may or may not be right for you, so you have to think about it and learn about it and ask the questions to make sure it is. We do follow the rules when we're on a trial and we're audited and we really try to get our best outcomes, but you also have to know that that may or may not be the right thing for you, as I've said. Now, I was asked to comment on two other areas. One is, what do we do for symptoms of acute myelogenous leukemia and for management of pain? What are the tips to help with that? I think compared to other cancers, pain is not usually as big an issue. Some other cancers, you can imagine that pain is a problem. For us, the biggest problems relate to the low blood counts and to fatigue. And so a lot of times, getting the best support for our patients means blood transfusions when they become anemic or platelet transfusions if their platelet count is very low. And platelet transfusions are not quite as effective or they don't last quite as long, but they've been a very important treatment to help people get through therapy when they're going through it. A lot of people, in my experience, suffer from fatigue. It's one of the hardest symptoms that comes up in acute myelogenous leukemia. It's also one of the most difficult because it's hard to tell is the fatigue from the leukemia or from the treatment for the leukemia or from the anemia. And what you really have to do is take it one person at a time to try and look for causes of fatigue that you can reverse, whether that's anemia or whether that's related to shortness of breath or something else. So that's kind of a hard one to address, but something we spend a lot of time trying to focus on. There have been studies in other cancers that show that getting help from our colleagues in palliative care earlier rather than later is very important to help improve how our patients feel, to make sure that they don't have nausea, to make sure that they don't have pain, and to help support them. And we have a pilot program at Mayo Clinic where we're getting palliative care involved very early as we treat our patients to help maximize how well we help we get them to feel or make them feel when they're going through their treatments. Almost everybody with leukemia can benefit from treatment. We can't cure everybody, but we know that almost everybody should be treated, that we can get a benefit, whether it's a remission or a better survival or a better quality of life than we would without therapy. So we know it's worth trying, but we also have to focus on making sure that people feel as well as they can. And if I had to give one piece of advice about how to do that, it's to make sure you communicate with your doctors and the nurses looking after you and the healthcare team, because you have to tell them how you feel in order for them to find a way to deal with a symptom or to improve upon a problem you're having. So please make sure you tell if you're having any side effect from therapy, whether it's nausea, which is rare for us, or pain, which is very uncommon, or fatigue, or any problem with your stomach, any rash. You want somebody to know, because there's always something we can do to help. I want to make one last point before I move on to the last section that they asked me to address, and that's that one area that I think we're trying to get better at is caring for the caregivers, because we focus so much attention on how to make the patient feel better, we sometimes don't spend as much attention on how to look after the people who are looking after them. And I tell many of my patients that one of the most important things that a husband, a wife, a child, a family member can do is to make sure they're looking after themselves and make sure that they're eating and sleeping so that they have the strength to help their family member go through it. Sometimes we don't spend enough time focusing on the caregiver. I think there are important questions to ask when you're diagnosed with leukemia or going through treatment for acute myelogenous leukemia to try to get the best therapy. And one of the early questions is there a clinical trial that I can be on or should be on? Is that an option for me? I think it's important to ask your doctor if they're a leukemia specialist and whether they have the support, all the support they need to get you through, because it's not a disease that every oncologist can treat just as easily. And sometimes being at a specialist center is a good idea. We're learning a lot about the genetics of acute myelogenous leukemia. We've learned that there are some mutations that are very hard to find, but when we find them, give us a treatment option. So it's important to ask whether mutation testing would be helpful. And we used to also say that we could not do bone marrow transplants in people over the age of 60 or 65, but we've learned that sometimes we can, even if they're 70 or older. So I think it's important to ask whether or not a bone marrow transplant is going to be an option. The last thing I would suggest as a question to ask would be, when should I get a blood transfusion, and what's the threshold in my hemoglobin before you'd give me a blood transfusion? Because there isn't a national move in the United States to say all people should get a blood transfusion when their hemoglobin is 7 or 8, but sometimes we can give blood transfusions at different thresholds to meet the needs of a specific person or what their symptoms are. So I think I'll stop at that point I'll stop at that point. Thank you very much.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Friend. That was very informative. A lot of good information for everybody, and I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A as well. And our next speaker is Ms. Anna Eckhart. Ms. Eckhart is an oncology social worker, and she is our online support group program coordinator at Cancer Care. And Ms. Eckhart is going to address the free psychosocial services that Cancer Care offers, as well as the role of support groups here. It's my pleasure now to turn the program over to Ms. Eckhart.
Thank you, Carolyn. It's really wonderful to be part of this important conversation about helping patients and loved ones cope with and attempt to understand AML. I would like to begin by speaking broadly and then more specifically about our services. There are many ways cancer care can be part of your network, and there are many ways we can help. Adjusting to and dealing with the diagnosis is an important part of the healing process, and as social workers, we would argue that it is an essential part. So here at Cancer Care, we're a nonprofit organization, and we provide free professional support services to anyone affected by cancer. And our services are provided by licensed master's-level oncology social workers, and everything is completely free of charge. So oncology social workers like myself are trained in how a diagnosis of cancer affects a person and his or her family and friends. Just like Dr. Foran said, caring for the caregiver, we're looking at everybody who's involved in this experience. We're also trained to help people with cancer and their families tackle the problems that accompany the disease, such as the financial demands, the physical changes, the social adjustment and psychological impact, and overall care, changes to their routine. Additionally, we provide education about resources and how to navigate the healthcare system, help you find practical help, and discuss some limited financial assistance. I want to also talk about the importance of creating a support network when you're diagnosed or if you're caring for someone with cancer. Asking for help by joining a support group or by contacting a social worker for counseling is a sign of strength. You do not have to walk this path alone. So joining a support group is a way to connect with others who are going through a similar situation or have similar problems. You can share experiences and learn from each other. And group members provide a listening ear and share tips and resources that they've utilized along the way. Cancer care support groups are moderated by the social workers, and we offer face-to-face support groups as well as telephone and online groups. And Caroline mentioned that I do coordinate the online support group program here. Currently, for those diagnosed, we offer an online blood cancer support group, and this is a 15-week online support group for those diagnosed with a blood cancer who are currently receiving treatment. And we have a post-treatment survivorship group for those who have finished active treatment and dealing with the emotional anticipation of upcoming scans, the distancing of support from friends and family that so often occurs, and the general fear of recurrence. And the online support group allows people from all over the world to write and share about their experiences. And so if you visit our website at www.cancercare.org, that would be the first step in the registration and screening for this and all of our online support groups. Caregivers can access support through our telephone and the online support groups. And the groups provide a safe environment. It's supportive, and then you can share your feelings and discuss the challenges and rewards of being a caregiver. Additionally, we have a really unique young adult program. And so the young adult program encompasses people who are between the ages of 20 and 39 years old. And the caregiver support group that we offer for online, we have one for young adults who perhaps are a spouse or partner of someone with AML, and a young adult general caregiver group who might have a parent or friend with a diagnosis. And if you choose to pursue individual counseling, this type of support provides a space that is just yours to voice any concerns, and that individual counseling would take place over the phone lines. All these connections help lessen the isolation that many people with cancer experience and the caregivers, and feeling well emotionally can help you better deal with the diagnosis and the treatment. So if you're interested in any of these services, you can call the Cancer Care Hopeline at 1-800-813-4673. Or if it's that online support group that's interesting you, then you can visit the website at www.cancercare.org. I want to state again that remember, you are not alone. Cancer care services are there to help you and connect you with other people going through something similar to you. And I really thank you for your attention and opportunity to talk.
Oh, thank you so much, Anna. That was wonderful and just very inviting in terms of all the different services that people can access from cancer care. And now we have time for questions. We actually have a lot of time for questions. I'm going to ask Stephanie to bring all of our speakers on board and to actually explain to everybody how to queue up for questions. And we're going to try to take as many of your questions as possible. Stephanie?
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. If you would like to ask a question, please press star then one on your touchtone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Those of you on the web may submit questions by clicking ask a question. Again, please press star then one to ask a question.
And we actually have a question from one of our online participants. So the question is, how do you identify neutropenic sepsis? Dr. Fran, could you actually I guess define that for everybody, and then if you could attempt to address that question in a general
way? Yeah, I'm happy to. Thank you. So neutropenic sepsis, that's kind of a medical term for when somebody has a low white cell count and they develop an infection. Sometimes we call it sepsis if the blood pressure is low, or sometimes just if there's a fever associated with it. But it's one of the complications of chemotherapy treatments for acute myelogenous leukemia. We've learned, really, we have 20 years of experience that... Oops, sorry. Is that my cue that I'm talking too long?
No, not at all.
No, right, I'm just coughing, Jim. Sorry.
Oh, are you okay?
I think everybody,
okay.
I mean, it probably resonates for everybody on the call, because I bet there are many people on the call with a cold or a cough. So if you hear a little bit of coughing on the call.
Oh, I apologize.
Okay.
No, I was just going to say, one of the complications of treatment is when you lower the white cell count to clear out the leukemia, the normal white blood cell counts go low, and you can get a fever or an infection. So it's very important when you're going through chemotherapy treatments that you monitor your temperature, that you call immediately to your doctor or to your nurse if you have a fever. And normally we initiate antibiotics very early to help treat it. Really, the signs are having a fever. That's the most important sign. And knowing you have a low white cell count or might have a low white cell count. There are different symptoms, whether there's a cough or whether there's a diarrhea or a rash or something else that can go with it. But the key to one to watch for is whether there's a fever. And many centers recommend patients don't take acetaminophen or Tylenol when they're having a low blood count, just so we can monitor properly for a fever and start antibiotics if that happens.
Excellent. That's very helpful to everybody. Thank you. And our next question from one of our online participants, from James. What specific agents are showing promise in AML treatment, and what mechanisms of action are proving to be successful? And Dr. Ravandi, could you address that in a general way?
Sure. You can actually probably divide this in two groups. There are traditional chemotherapy-like agents that are in development, and some of them have shown interesting results. And there are also, as I mentioned earlier, targeted agents targeted against specific gene abnormalities that also some of them are showing a lot of interesting results, early results.
Oh, absolutely. That would be helpful, I think, for people to know.
Okay.
That. Yes, absolutely.
So, for example, there is a drug called CPX351, which is essentially the traditional cytarabine and anthracycline that I mentioned earlier in my presentation, the classical drugs that we use for AML, which is actually encapsulated in a liposome or a lipid or a fatty globule. And without going into too much details, this makes it potentially more effective, at least in some patients, and definitely less toxic in some ways. So it's being evaluated in a big randomized trial. There is another drug which probably I wouldn't call it new, but it's called clofarabine, and James is the lead investigator in a national randomized trial where they compare the traditional chemo, RSC and anthracycline to clofarabine in older patients. So we will hopefully soon hear about the usefulness of that drug. And again, that's more of a traditional chemotherapy agent. There was a drug that was evaluated in a randomized trial in patients with first relapse AML, and that's called vozaroxin. And at least in older patients, it's shown superiority to just RSC alone. There's another drug called volasertib, which is also being evaluated mainly in the older patients as a less toxic strategy, but I probably shouldn't call that chemotherapy because it's not a classical chemotherapy agent by standard criteria. There are a number of targeted agents. Probably the most advanced are drugs called FLT3 inhibitors. FLT3 is a protein on the surface of all bone marrow cells, but it's mutated in a number of leukemia cells. And when it gets mutated, it causes proliferation of the leukemia cells. And inhibitors of FLT3 have been developed, and a number have been evaluated. There is one that hopefully we'll soon hear about called midostaurin that was evaluated in a very large international randomized trial, phase three trial, as going back to James's presentation. And again, we will hopefully hear about whether it improves the outcomes. There's a drug called sorafenib, which is a drug that is actually approved for kidney cancer and liver cancer. But we have been able to show that it's active in AML, and recently there was a randomized trial from Germany that was presented that showed that it does improve outcomes in AML patients. That's still a point of debate, but it is definitely an option, and it's also useful in the relapse setting for people who have this FLT3 abnormality or mutation. And there are actually a number of newer FLT3 inhibitors. One is called quizartinib, and there's a few that still don't even have a name. And these are being evaluated in phase 1 and 2 trials and phase 3 trials. And so we will soon know that the addition of these FLT3 inhibitors is beneficial for the treatment of patients with AML. There's been a lot of interest in the metabolism of leukemia cells. IDH1 and IDH2 are a couple of enzymes, and again, these are in normal cells. Every cell in the body has these enzymes, but they are mutated in about 10 to 20% of leukemia cells, patients with leukemia. And there's a drug that is being, there are a couple of drugs that are being evaluated, inhibitors of IDH1 and IDH2, and they have shown interesting early results. And as I mentioned, they're oral drugs, relatively non-toxic, and so they would be very exciting if we can confirm in longer term their usefulness. And then there is another drug called ABT-199, which is also a targeted agent, an oral agent, and that also may turn out to be an effective agent in AML therapy. And again, these are in early studies. I think Dr. Foran mentioned monoclonal antibodies in other cancers, and there are a number of monoclonal antibodies in leukemia, in AML. When I say monoclonal antibody, these are antibodies that are raised against a specific target on the leukemia cells. And to date, the most commonly used target is this molecule called CD33, which tends to occur on the surface of most leukemia cells, and as such is a good target for developing a specific antibody. And there are a number of studies that are looking at these monoclonal antibodies attached to a toxin that delivers the toxin directly to the leukemia cells. One of them is called SGN-CD33A, and that is undergoing evaluation at the moment in clinical trials. It's certainly an effective drug in lowering blood counts. And we will hopefully soon know how to use these more in combination with other agents. And there are a number of other areas of interest. In all cancers, there's enormous interest now to reactivate the interaction with the interaction between the patient's own immune system and cancer cells. So there are mechanisms by cancer cells that help them evade patient's own immune system to essentially nullify their patient's own immune system to get rid of cancer cells. And there are a number of drugs that are being developed to try to reactivate this process and essentially awaken the patient's own immune system. Now, in AML, there is not a lot of data on this, and whether it's going to be interesting or not, we will know, but not for at least a couple of years or even more. And there is a strong interest in a disease called ALL, or acute lymphoblastic leukemia, for a product called CAR T cells, and these are, again, immune-based therapies, and I suspect we will soon have CAR T cells for AML as well, but again, that's not going to be available for at least a couple of years, probably. And those are the things that come to mind. There are numerous other agents, a number of drugs that are targeted against various molecular abnormalities, but these are probably the more interesting and advanced ones.
That's excellent. Thank you very much. And Dr. Friend, did you want to add anything to that?
No, that's an amazing list of presentation. It's and fantastically presented by Dr. Rivandi. But I want to make a sort of summary comment to say that that list should give you an idea of the work that's being done at many centers to really try and make things better. And we don't have the answer yet, but we're trying hard on multiple fronts, and some of these look very have great potential. So.
Excellent. This is very good, excellent. And we have a question from one of another online participant in terms of the fatigue, feeling fatigue all the time, and what can I do to have more energy? And I know that you addressed this, Dr. Fran, a bit, but if you could say a bit more about this, it sounds like that's important. There are a few people asking that question about the fatigue.
It is important, and it's really frustrating, and it's one of the hardest things to go through and not always easy to turn around for people. And I break it down into a couple of different approaches. The first is I look to see if there's some other contributing cause to the fatigue. So I like to know. I want to make sure that the person doesn't have hypothyroidism or a low B12 level or something else that could be contributing that's easy to replace. So we often will check a thyroid test. The second is that fatigue is often related to anemia, so that when your red cell count is low, people feel more tired. Not everybody needs to run a higher red cell count or get transfused, but sometimes extra transfusions can help. You can't take it too far, but you can certainly do a little more sometimes for people. The third, and this is a really difficult one, is that a lot of people get worn out by the process and frankly can have depression or anxiety creep in because it's such a difficult thing to go through. And we sometimes find that learning whether there's an element of depression and talking about trying to give something to treat the depression will help. Now, not quite the same thing as fatigue is loss of appetite, but there are things we can do. They seem to go hand in hand sometimes, and there are things we can do to try to stimulate appetite. And in the end, it's usually a finite problem. And what I mean by that is often the fatigue will get better if we can control the leukemia, especially when you're going through chemotherapy treatments early on, so that you'll often find you can go through it. You just have to hang in there to get through it. It's not an easy problem, though, I have to say.
Thank you. This is really and what a question for Anna Eckhart. Do you have any tips to deal with the emotional stress of undergoing treatment? If you'd like to just comment on that, Ms. Eckhart, in terms of some of the things that you observe in the work that you're doing here and the support groups and with people you're working with individually as well.
Well, I do think considering the support group that you have and thinking about what your friends and family are able to offer, considering where people's strengths are, certainly understanding, you know, where their time limits might be, but, you know, considering the skills and the strengths of your friends and family. And it can be very frustrating when the people that you feel very close to are either not able or ready or not even emotionally available to be a support for you, when perhaps that was someone who was very close to you, someone that was very involved, and someone that you leaned on and really thought was a bigger part of your life. And that doesn't mean that they're not. It just might mean that in this particular case, whether it be practical support or emotional support, many times people who are in treatment are upset and saddened by the distancing of friends and family that they thought were there for them. And so just considering, just knowing that, I think is a big thing, and just making room for that. And you don't have to understand other people's experiences. You're going through something yourself that is a major deal. But that is often, that's something that I just hear over and over again, whether that be in the caregiver groups or the patient groups or people who are post-treatment, just noticing that the people that they did think were major parts of their lives might be pulling away or just not there in the way that they need. And it is perhaps an opportunity, even though it's not something you might want, to find out who else might be in your life that can be that support. So one of the things I think about in treatment, there are some really great websites that are helpful in organizing the practical needs while you're in treatment. There's an organization called Lots of Helping Hands. It's a website where people can post on a calendar the practical things they need, whether that be help with doing laundry once a week or someone to clean the bathroom or someone to pick up the kids after school while they're in treatment. And caregivers, friends, and loved ones really can respond well to these practical pieces of support. You know, it's just maybe one time or a weekly situation. People can really rally around that. It's not something vague, or and you can also then depend on them. And it's, these websites are really great because you see what's in the calendar, who signed up for what. If you have email access, both them and you get an email letting you know who signed up for what, and there's a reminder. So I think that that can be really supportive and helpful during treatment for the person who's going through this. Oftentimes it'll be a family member or friend who will set up the site with Lots of Helping Hands. I think the website is www.lotsa, like Lotsa, and then Helping Hands. And I apologize, I just don't remember if it's .com or .org. But anyway, it is something that caregivers and friends and family can set up, and then that can be a helpful thing for the patient. And like I said, it's you get practical support, and people can really rally around that because it is sometimes a one-time or time-sensitive thing. So those are just a few things off the top of my head. Anything else that you want me to speak about, Carolyn?
That sounds excellent. And, of course, whenever in doubt, you certainly can call our, and which I know Ms. Eckhart has covered, our helpline here at Cancer Care at 1-800-813-HOPE when you're struggling with those issues. So that's really important. Thank you. We do have another question from one of our online participants. So our online participants are very active today, I must say. So the question is about the flu season, the winter, although I know we're hoping the winter is coming to a close soon in those northern parts of the country, but nevertheless, are there any extra measure I can take during cold and flu season, or in general just protecting self from cold and flus? And I'm wondering if Dr. Ferran, if you could comment on that.
Yeah, I can. I'm probably in an unusual situation because I live in Florida. And it is in the 50s today, but it was 80 yesterday. So we have slightly different weather issues. But the cold season and flu season is an issue. I think it's important to get the flu vaccine if you can, as long as you don't have a contraindication or an allergy to getting it. More importantly, I think that family members and caregivers should get a flu vaccination to help minimize the risk of flu when it's flu season. We're coming towards the end of that now. But if you do have symptoms of flu with muscle aches or pain, then you should report that to your medical team, because there are treatments for it, such as oseltamivir, which is called Tamiflu, as long as you start it within the first 1 to 2 days. So if you get flu symptoms, you must let somebody know, because there are treatments to help. Sometimes people who have a low immune system or low white cell count need a longer course of that, but it's an oral treatment that's not hard to take. And I think the flu vaccine should be given, especially to family members, to try to help.
Excellent. And patients themselves can get the flu vaccines, or how does that work?
You definitely can. It's just that it's a little bit controversial because we don't know the right time to give it. Some studies say you should give it when your white cell count is low before it comes up. Others say give it any time you can, but it's not going to be as effective. So it doesn't work quite as well when you're in the midst of treatment for leukemia, but it's better than not getting it. Usually we wait for the counts to come up and then try to get it and hope it helps. That's why I say we should try to vaccinate the people around you to minimize the chance that you can be exposed to flu.
That's an excellent point. And what about the vaccines being live, or how does that?
So the flu vaccine itself is not a live vaccine, but when you're going through chemotherapy, it's generally recommended that you – well, again, this is a little bit controversial. If there's a bone marrow transplant involved, we certainly say you should not have a live vaccination. Some types of chemotherapy you can get live vaccination, sometimes you can't. So I think that's a decision you have to discuss directly with your medical team to make sure they know if there's a risk for you. But the flu vaccine is not a live vaccine. That one specifically should be okay.
Excellent. Okay.
I can't actually stress enough the importance of hand contact. I tell my patients that you should not essentially shake hands with somebody unless you've seen them washing their hands in front of you. And I make a point when I go to see any of my patients in the clinic, fortunately we have wash basins, and I do it in front of them before I start examining them. Many people worry about wearing masks and everything else, but I think there are studies that have shown the best way to avoid viral infections is by minimizing hand contact, and I think that is a good way of trying to reduce your risk of getting viral illnesses. It doesn't obviously eliminate it, but it's one way of trying to minimize your risk or lower your risk.
Well, I have to say this is an extraordinary call. I want to thank all of our speakers. You've been extraordinary. And I want to thank also all of you who've actually had these wonderful questions online. And there are some more questions coming in. So I do want to remind everyone that actually please do call our oncology social work staff at Cancer Care at 1-800-813-HOPE with any questions you didn't get to ask. And also, just so you all know, that the website that that Ms. Eckhart was giving out, it is www.lotsahelpinghands.com. And you'll all be getting that both as an announcement just about now, or online, live streaming, and all of you will get this also in your in our follow-up evaluations to you, so you'll all get that those resources as well. Now, most importantly, as we're about to conclude this call, I wouldn't want anyone to think that you're alone in coping with AML or any type of hematologic cancer or cancer in general. I want you to know that you're now part of a support world here at Cancer Care, and that we are here to help you, and that we are simply a phone call away, or you can visit our website or email us as well, because we are really here to help you, and we know that questions and concerns will come up for each of you when the call ends. You may think of a question that you didn't get to ask. So please do take advantage of these services. They are free. Also, remember your healthcare team as well. Medical questions, you definitely want to direct your healthcare team. Sometimes people do call us at Cancer Care for help in how to ask the questions or even to get permission to ask the questions. I know a lot of you, I think both Dr. Avandi and Dr. Ferrand, stress the fact that it's okay to ask your physician and healthcare team questions, but I know that sometimes people are reticent even to call between appointments. So we want to be sure that you do call whenever something is troubling you. I think that's really very important to your healthcare team. And do also call us at Cancer Care for any practical financial issues, any of the counseling concerns you may have, support groups, informational pieces. We're here to help you. And when you're not sure who to call, give us a call. We're here. Again, I want to thank you all for your participation today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop. You may now disconnect, and everyone have a wonderful day.